You're with SBS Radio. Find more great stories in your language at sbs.com.au.
I have always believed in miracles.
I intend to hasten slowly. We need to be not despairing about the outcome. We need to be determined.
The insurgents were not rewarded.
I'd rather be a loser than a quitter.
The journey's not going to be easy, and that's why I've asked people to walk with me.
Anyone who doesn't support constitutional recognition will regret it.
The Australian people have got the tax cuts that they voted for.
You know what politics like? It changes more than what you change your undies.
How good is Australia? Yeah!
Hello, I'm Brett Mason in the gallery for SBS World News. In the final week of the federal election campaign, Scott Morrison told me this when I asked him to articulate his vision for Australia's foreign policy.
There are the great world tensions between the United States and China, and my view has always been is you don't have to pick sides in that. You don't have to walk away from the relationships that you have, that you stand by your friends and you stand by your customers as well. China is an incredibly important country for Australia's future. Our relationship with China is, of course, different to our relationship with the United States, but they are both critical to Australia's future.
Apart from his eyebrow-raising choice of language, his answer posed another big question. Can Australia really have its cake and eat it too?
When political leaders like Scott Morrison say that Australia doesn't have to choose between America and China, what they're really doing is expressing their hope.
In a moment, prominent defence analyst Hugh White. But first, here's Pablo Vinales with his take on the week that was.
Thanks, Brett. Well, the government started the week trying to stave off an issue that's been brewing for years. Deeming rates. Now, they may be complicated to understand, but it affects over a million people. Deeming rates are used to calculate the income earned on financial assets at a set rate, regardless of the actual return. The government then takes that into account to adjust the pensions of over 600,000 pensioners. The problem, though, with record low interest rates, it wasn't reflecting the returns pensioners were getting. On Sunday, the Social Services Minister, Anne Rustin, announced that would change.
I believe it's appropriate for us to drop both the upper and the lower deeming rates so that we can continue to reflect in the deeming rates the rates of return that people are receiving on their financial assets. Well, I mean, obviously it's more money in their pockets. It's more money in their pockets every fortnight. So that is a good thing. I mean, we all like to have more money in our pockets.
Singles affected will be about $800 better off and couples $1,000. But the change also renewed pressure for the government to increase Newstart. It hasn't been significantly increased for over 25 years. The calls this week getting support from within with Nationals MP Barnaby Joyce.
Certainly $555 or so, thereabouts a fortnight is difficult, especially in regional areas. If your rent's costing you $250 a week, well, you're not really going to get by unless you've got some cash income on the side, and maybe that's what's there for. But, you know, I want to make sure that people try and get a job, and I want to make sure that we're not encouraging people to do things that are illegal. Like, I suppose you can get another cash job selling drugs.
The federal government also met with states and territories this week to discuss the crisis around combustible cladding on high-rise buildings. A deal has been struck on construction industry reform, but the government won't give in to demands from the states to help fund for the removal of the material. While Parliament wasn't sitting this week, both the Prime Minister and opposition leader shared the stage at the Bush Summit in Dubbo. Mr. Morrison announcing plans to boost agriculture into a $100 billion industry by 2030 and challenging Labor to back its $5 billion future drought fund next week in Canberra.
I mean, he is constantly looking for excuses to oppose things. So you've got to ask yourself about this guy. What's he for? And who's he for? I can't work it out. And I think Australians are asking the same question. So next week he's got a chance to answer the question. We asked him the other week about, are you for tax relief? And he said no. And now we're asking him, are you for the drought fund? Well, it seems to be saying no at the moment.
Anthony Albanese telling the PM to stop playing politics.
I want more money for Bridget McKenzie's portfolio, but I don't want it at the expense of Michael McCormick's. It's that simple. And I say to the government, don't play politics with this. It's too important. Just stop it. Provide the funding with appropriations as you should, and we'll back it.
And briefly, the PM is ending the week by meeting with New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern in Melbourne. It's the first meeting since Mr Morrison went to New Zealand to pay his respects to the victims of the Christchurch terrorist attack.
Amid rising trade tensions between China and the United States, there are calls for Australia to consider its own nuclear deterrence program. I sat down with Hugh White here at Parliament House to find out where these trade tensions leave Australia.
Look, I think, you know, we are facing a much tougher and more difficult future than I think our political leaders have realised, or at least are prepared to admit. And then, in fact, Australia has faced for a very long time. And that's because the whole foundation of Australia's international setting for the last 30 years, really, has been that America remains the dominant strategic power in Asia, keeps Asia stable and Australia safe, while China's economic growth provides the rocket fuel for our economy. And that's been great for us. But it only worked as long as the US and China were working well together. And when political leaders like Scott Morrison say that Australia doesn't have to choose between America and China, what they're really doing is expressing their hope, not a realistic expectation or prediction. Because increasingly, as both the US and China see one another as rivals, economic rivals and strategic rivals, and as their competition intensifies, Australia does face tougher and tougher pressures to make choices. And we also have to start asking ourselves, where is this competition leading? Who's going to win it? What kind of region and what kind of world will we live in when it's over? And what can we do now to position ourselves for the most likely outcomes? And all of that poses for Australia some of the biggest challenges to our foreign policy in our entire history, and certainly the biggest challenges we've faced in a couple of generations.
Is it sustainable for Australia to have its cake and eat it too and say, well, we want to get along with both of these countries, when at some point that tension wire is likely to snap and Australia will have to fall one side or the other?
Well, it's certainly sensible for Australia to want that, but I think it's unwise for us to assume we can have it, in part because what matters is not what we want. What matters is what those two countries expect. The more intense the competition between America and China becomes, the more both sides will expect us, demand that we take their side against the other. And we can see that happening already. As the tensions have increased over the last year or two, America has been putting pressure on Australia to side with America in the trade war, in the strategic contest, and the Chinese have been putting pressure on us not to. And so, you know, the Huawei issue, for example, where we came under a lot of pressure from Washington to refuse Huawei's access to our 5G infrastructure, a lot of pressure under China to change that bid. That's the example of the kind of tensions that Australia's going to face, and it will get worse, I think, because I think the rivalry will continue to grow. So one way or another, we are going to end up making some big choices. We're already making big choices, in fact, all the time. But also we need to recognise in the longer term that it's quite possible, I think most likely, that America will end up losing this contest with China, that China will end up as the dominant power, at least in East Asia and the Western Pacific, which is where we're located. And American influence and power in our region will decline. So whatever happens, we're going to have to learn to come to terms with a more powerful China, and we're going to have to expect less support from the United States than we would have expected in the past.
Do you think the United States shares that view? What's been really interesting is that Australia is stepping up, as the Prime Minister likes to say, its presence in the Pacific. And we've seen the United States almost falling over themselves trying to be nice to Scott Morrison. He's going to Washington in September, a big state dinner. We haven't seen this since the Howard years. Does the United States really need Australia in order to be competitive against China in the region? And how successful has that partnership been?
Well, I think the US certainly hopes for Australia's support. But how hard they're going to press and what exactly they're going to press for depends a bit on who we're talking about in Washington, because Washington's not just one thing anymore, particularly under the Trump administration. It's, you know, heading in a lot of different directions. Donald Trump himself is very focused on his trade war with China, and I'm sure he will be asking and expecting Morrison to provide stronger support than Australia's so far been willing to provide. Morrison has in fact been quite critical of Trump's trade war with China, of American policy as well as Chinese policy. Trump, I think, is going to want to push Morrison to side more overtly with the United States. Morrison's going to be very reluctant to do that. On the strategic side, particularly with senior people in administration like John Bolton, they are really expecting Australia to sign up to their vision of the US-China strategic rivalry as being one which is bitter and has to be won by America. Again, Morrison has distanced himself from that. Morrison has been keen to say he doesn't see the US-China relationship as one of as adversaries. And I think that disappoints Washington, and I think Washington, people like John Bolton, will be hoping that Morrison can be persuaded to side more overtly with Washington against China on the strategic side as well as the economic side. So I think it's potentially for Morrison a very tough visit as well as being a big honour.
And the interesting thing about President Trump, we've seen that in the last few days with Turkey, for example. The US State Department, the US Department of Defense has been pushing him to increase sanctions because of this Russian missile system that Turkey's bought against the US demands. But President Trump's held back from that. He seems to be quite willing to make executive decisions. How important is that personal relationship between Scott Morrison and Donald Trump, do you think, in order to maintain that cool-headed balance between Canberra and Washington?
It's a really important question because nobody so far has worked out how to deal with Donald Trump. He just doesn't play diplomacy according to the old rules. And it's not really clear that he understands or is interested in diplomacy as it's traditionally conceived. So I think it's very uncertain that Morrison can really negotiate with Trump the way Australian prime ministers have expected to be able to negotiate and do deals and reach understandings which stick for sustained periods of time. We haven't seen Trump in that mode, and I don't think Morrison's going to have any different experience. So I do think it's a very difficult environment for Morrison to operate in. And of course, it goes to the broader question as to whether we can be confident where America's going in the longer term. As I mentioned before, there are people like John Bolton, who are very focused on the strategic contest with China. But Trump himself, it's much less clear that he really buys that whole strategic rivalry argument. For him, it's an economic rivalry. And so I think one of the reasons we must be careful about assuming that America is going to remain a strong power in Asia indefinitely is that Trump and the people who vote for Trump, maybe the American electorate at large, is not really as interested in that as the Washington insiders are. And in the long run, in a democracy, it's what the people rather than what the insiders say that really counts.
So if the US interest shifts in the region, that leaves Australia as the biggest US alliance in the region with a front row seat. Yes. What does that mean for Australian foreign policy in the region?
Well, we have to do, I think, two things. The first is acknowledge that we're going to be living in a region, both broader Western Pacific, East Asia region, and more narrowly in our own South Pacific region, that China is going to be a more powerful and more influential player here than any power we've ever encountered before, except for Britain and America. And so this is a new kind of experience for us. And we're going to have to work out how to deal with China, first and foremost, how to deal with a country that's that powerful and that influential in a way that means we don't just give away everything they ask for, but we act smart, we weigh the costs and benefits of conceding to China on some things and standing up to China on others. And I don't think so far we've seen that kind of sophistication in the way we've approached China. The second thing is we have to work much more carefully with other countries. We're all going to have interest in exploiting the benefits that are available from dealing with China as much as possible without falling too far under China's sway. And that's true of these countries in the South Pacific. It's true of our larger neighbours like Indonesia and countries like India and Japan as well. So across the board, Australia has to start a more supple and fluid diplomacy in which we accept China as a very powerful regional state with a lot of influence. We work with it effectively. We concede to China where that's the most effective thing to do. We stand up to China where we must. And we work more effectively with other countries to help manage the situation and work in coalitions where we can.
You say that China would be the biggest power we've seen other than the UK and the US. Both of those countries, if they do step back from the Pacific and from Asia more broadly, where does that leave Australia in terms of its defences? We've traditionally relied on both of those countries.
Yes, well, that is a really critical question because, you know, Australia, as far as our defence policy is concerned, for decades now, has assumed that America would be powerful enough to stop any threat to Australia developing, and that if somehow a threat anyway did develop, that America would come to our aid. And that's meant that our defence forces haven't really had to to be designed to defend Australia independently except anything against anything but the smallest threats. Now, particularly when we look not 10 or 12 years into the future, but 15 or 20 or 30 years into the future, which is what you have to do in defence planning, we have to ask ourselves, should Australia overhaul our defence policy and aim to be able to defend ourselves independently, even from a major Asian power? Now, we've always assumed we couldn't do that. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think we can. We'd need to plan very carefully. We'd need to design our forces very specifically to do what's most important for them to do. We'd need to spend a lot of money. But I think it's possible that we could. And I think one of the big questions that Australia faces is whether we want to make that effort, make that investment, or just drift along through the next few decades, hoping for the best, hoping that China will be a benign and benevolent major power rather than an aggressive and hostile one.
And what would that investment look like? We've already seen Australia in the last few years make some big investments, the future submarines. Already there have been questions asked about whether they're mission ready by the time they're deliverable to Australia. What would that step up militarily look like?
Look, I think the right at the core of it is to understand that the key thing for Australia is to prevent any hostile power from being able to project power by sea towards us. You know, we are an island, and not just Australia, but all our neighbours, all our close neighbours are also islands. So what we want to be able to do more than anything else is to prevent other countries projecting power by sea towards us or towards our neighbours. Now, that's very different from projecting power ourselves. The big problem I see in the way we've gone over the last couple of decades, really, is that we've focused the development of our defence forces on our capacity to project power against others, whereas what we want to do is to reverse that and adopt what is strategically at least a more defensive mode. Now, that means we need to spend much less money on big warships, much less money on amphibious forces, I think much more money on submarines and more money on combat aircraft. But on the submarine side, I think I agree with the concerns that have been raised about the present project. I think the chances are that the submarines we're now aiming to buy from France are going to be, there could be too few of them, they'll arrive too late. And technically, they may well, as others have pointed out, be outdated by the time they arrive. I think we need to move faster, to build more submarines, to a more familiar and established design. And my own conclusion is that the best bet is to take the design we already have, the Collins design, which has turned into a very good submarine, a big submarine, it's got long range, it's got the key things we're after. We should evolve that design, take advantage of new technologies, perhaps including lithium ion batteries rather than lead acid batteries and some other new innovations that are available. But aim to build on the design we already have rather than buying a brand new one from France.
The big question is the nuclear question, whether Australia needs to have a deterrent program and what that might look like. You've suggested the idea of having a deterrent program, a nuclear submarine program. Why would that be something that Australia should consider?
Well, this is a really hard question. It sits right at the core, I think, of our thinking about our strategic future. I'm one of those who think that Australia has been incredibly lucky and very wise for decades to simply refuse to contemplate nuclear weapons. And I would love it to be the case that we can continue to do that indefinitely into the future. But the fact is that what's one of the reasons why it's made so much sense for Australia not to go the nuclear route in recent decades has been that we've been very confident of America's willingness to defend us from any nuclear threat through its extended nuclear deterrent. Now, as long as that remains true, it makes no sense for Australia to rethink its approach to nuclear weapons. But when we look 20 or 30 or 40 years into the future, we've got to ask ourselves, how sure can we be that America will still be so committed to Australia's security, so committed to its place in Asia, that it will be willing to risk a nuclear attack on itself in order to shield Australia from a nuclear threat? And I think it's very hard not to conclude that that's going to be less reliable than it has been. Now, I'm not sure that means we should go out and build nuclear weapons ourselves. On the contrary, I think it's a very, very serious decision, which I myself would be extremely reluctant to take. But I do think we have to recognise that that's something we're going to have to debate as a country, whether we're willing to pay the financial costs, the diplomatic costs, the moral costs of taking that very serious step, or whether we're just, as we see US extended deterrence fade, whether we're just prepared to hope for the best. Maybe that's the best solution, but that is not something that governments should take for granted. That's something that we as a country really have to talk our way through.
There would obviously be a diplomatic knock-on effect from that.
Huge.
What would our neighbours make of such a decision?
Well, it's a really important point. One of the very important issues that needs to be considered in that is how it affects other countries' perceptions of Australia. And I would be very careful myself about any decision which seemed likely, any decision on nuclear weapons, or for that matter, conventional weapons, which seemed likely to make other countries more anxious about Australia's intentions and more hostile towards us. On the other hand, the same choices, the same questions that we face, the questions I've just raised, are also ones that are being faced all over the Pacific and, for that matter, elsewhere in the world. If you go to Germany, if you go to Japan, if you go to South Korea, see a whole range of countries who have depended on US extended nuclear deterrence, who now, looking at the way in which US power and influence is declining, asking whether 20 or 30 or 40 years from now, America will still be providing the kind of extended deterrence that we have benefited from in the past, and asking themselves, do we have to take the same step? I think it would be very unlikely that Australia will be the first country in Asia that is not now a nuclear power that might make this step. I think it's much more likely that Japan or South Korea, for example, would take the step first. And I think one of the things we should do is watch their debates. If the people of Japan decide that they can continue to remain secure without nuclear weapons, notwithstanding a decline in US credibility in the region, then I think it makes much more sense for Australia to reach the same conclusion. If, on the other hand, they decide that their security does require them to acquire nuclear weapons, that makes it more compelling, not, I think, decisive, but more compelling for Australia to take the same step.
So perhaps something like the French program, where they have...
In terms of what kind of nuclear forces it might make sense conceivably for Australia to consider, a very important part of my thinking about this is the only reason Australia would want nuclear weapons is to deter attack on us by others. No conception at all of Australia having a war-fighting capability. That would mean the most sensible kind of nuclear posture for us would be one like France has or Britain has, where you have a small, very small nuclear deterrent mounted on submarines, ballistic missile-firing submarines, because they're the most secure form of nuclear deterrent.
It might seem like a flippant question, but why would anyone want to launch an attack on Australia?
Oh, look,
we're sort of seen as a difficult country to conquer, and what would the outcome be ultimately?
Look, it's a really important question, actually, because it's very easy to start talking about defence as if it's a given that necessarily we need all of this stuff. I don't take that for granted. Some countries, many countries in the world, make their way through life without really being able to defend themselves. And it's not immediately clear to me that Australia couldn't and shouldn't take that gamble. Hope for the best. We are, after all, relatively remote. But I think we need to be careful presuming that that's not a risk, that there's no possibility that a country could seek to use force against Australia. It's worth remembering that, you know, when we think of Australia's history, the last 50 years has been very peaceful, very stable. But if we look at the 50 years before that, Australia went through a period of extraordinary tension and instability, including, of course, very direct threats to our own security in the early 1940s. Now, I'm not saying that we'd necessarily see a repeat of that, but the question we have to ask ourselves is not how likely it is that Australia would face a direct threat in the Asia we live in today. It's whether Asia might change in ways that makes that kind of threat less unlikely. And I think that is quite possible. An Asia in which America is less powerful, in which China is more powerful, in which India is more powerful, in which Indonesia is more powerful, in which those countries are all competing with one another and seeking to put pressure on other countries in those contexts. That's the kind of situation which throughout history conflicts have arisen. And I don't think Australia can necessarily assume that our geography or our history or our political structure or whatever will just make us immune from that. We haven't been immune from it in the past. I don't think we can assume we will be immune from it in the future.
In terms of diplomacy, how can Australia be involved in those conversations? Because you're right, it's not just China. India, I think, is one country that often gets forgotten in the debate about policy and security. Indonesia, how can Australia be involved at a diplomatic level as well as a military one?
Now, it's a really important question because obviously one of the really important things we should be doing is whatever we can to help shape the way the region evolves, to prevent the kind of hostile, contested environment in which those defence forces would become important to our security. So that has to be a very high priority. How do we go about doing that? Well, the first thing to do is to acknowledge that we have a problem. One of the problems with Australian diplomacy on this issue for the last decade or so is that our political leaders on both sides of politics have been so busy saying we don't have to choose between America and China that they've conveyed the impression that they don't think there's any challenge to face. Now, just in the last year or so, Australian political leaders have started to become a bit more frank and open in acknowledging the contest between America and China, the rivalry between them, the significance of China's growing ambitions and power, and the very complex decisions the region has to have. So I think we need to really start getting engaged in that. The next thing we need to do is to recognise that other countries are not necessarily going to see this exactly the same way we do. For example, for a long time, Australia's diplomacy towards India has presupposed that India is going to be a kind of an asset for Australia and America in confronting China, that India is going to be a kind of a card we can play in the game with China. That's a very big mistake. India has its own strategic agenda. It's going to pursue its own interests, and they're not necessarily going to be the same with ours. Likewise, Japan, there's been a lot of, I think, very vague talk in Australia about the idea of Australia and Japan should have an alliance as we confront China. But we can't presume that Japan's going to see issues in relation to China the same way we do. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. Japan's equities and interests and objectives in their relationship with China are going to be different from ours, and ours will be different from theirs. So I think we have to be more sophisticated in the way in which we understand other countries' objectives and less optimistic about the idea that we can simply put our arms around other big players like India and Japan and go along with them. And lastly, we have to focus on the countries that are closest to us, in the South Pacific and Indonesia. Indonesia, I think, is especially extremely important in this. Indonesia itself will be a great power in the decades to come. You know, credible estimates are that Indonesia will have the fourth biggest economy in the world before the middle of this century, which is not that far away. And so it'll be a regional great power in its own right. Now, if we can manage our relations with Indonesia well, if we can build a sense of shared strategic objectives with Indonesia over those decades, then Indonesia's strength will be a great asset to us. If, on the other hand, we get that wrong, if our relations with Indonesia continue to drift along, as I think they've done in recent decades, then I think Indonesia could become a real strategic liability for us. So we need to focus on those close countries as well.
And just finally, in the days after the G20 summit in Osaka, we saw the US president in the demilitarized zone with Chairman Kim from North Korea. It was a pretty extraordinary moment. What do you see the significance in terms of negotiating peace on the peninsula? Was this just a photo opportunity in your mind?
No, I think it is bigger than that. I think we are seeing a very significant shift on the Korean Peninsula. Partly we're seeing America, or at least Donald Trump as president, accepting that North Korea is probably going to remain a nuclear power. I think, you know, right at the heart of what we've seen in the last couple of weeks is the acknowledgement in Washington that they don't have the leverage to force North Korea to denuclearize. But also behind that, we've seen something I think even bigger. North Korea and South Korea are starting to look at a model of their future together, which is not unification, and nor is it hostility. It's cohabitation. It's coexistence. And it does seem that North Korea is prepared to contemplate that future. It's very clear that President Moon in South Korea is prepared to contemplate that future. So I think we're now heading down a track, not there yet, but we're heading down a track towards a de-escalation of tensions on the Korean Peninsula, which in the long run looks to me like very good news for China and bad news for America, at least bad news for America strategically, because if the lower tensions become on the Korean Peninsula, the less need there is for the US forces to remain there, the more likely it is that US forces will be withdrawn, the weaker Americans' overall position in the Western Pacific will become, and therefore, because this is the way power politics works, the stronger China's position will become. So I think it's a very important moment, not just in the history of the Korean Peninsula, but in the evolution of the entire future strategic order in Asia.
Hugh White, thank you very much.
My great pleasure. Thanks, Brett.
SBS acknowledges the Ngunnawal people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which the Australian Parliament sits and where this program was recorded. We pay respect to the elders of the Ngunnawal Nation, both past and present.
Tell us what you think. Rate this podcast on iTunes. It helps other people to find us.